You are listening to The Partially Examined Life, episode 151, part 2 on Edmund Burke's Reflections on the Revolution in France. Last time we talked about what his variation on social contract theory is, and we're in the middle of a discussion of why he thinks that you should try to reform instead of rebel, even if you are the one being trampled underfoot all the time. And in particular, the last point we ended on, Wes had brought up the issue of why he's in favor of inheritance. That seems to be the thing that we consider pretty damn unjust.
Well, one thing I'll say is that, you know, the word inheritance, as you trying to search on that, is not productive, because he's usually using that to refer to inherited titles from one king to another, or the inheritance of our rights, the inheritance of our customs. But there's also a few points in our reading where he talks about the importance of property, interestingly enough. On my page 51, the context for this is criticism of the assemblies, including all these unpropertied people. Nothing is a due and adequate representation of a state that does not represent its ability as well as its property. But as ability is a vigorous and active principle, and as property is sluggish, inert, and timid, it never can be safe from the invasion of ability unless it be, out of all proportion, predominant in the representation. In other words, the only way the property classes are going to protect their property is if they have control over the representative bodies. Otherwise, they're going to get pillaged.
See, originally I read this as a positive thing, because he's just done saying how, come on, I'm not just saying only the rich can get in power. Yeah, somebody with enough ability can get the upper hand, can get a hold of your property or gain political power despite lack of property.
No, he's saying it can never be safe from the invasion of ability unless it be predominant in the representation. But maybe let's just read on and we'll see. It must be represented, too, in great masses of accumulation, or it is not rightly protected. The characteristic essence of property, formed out of the combined principles of its acquisition and conservation, is to be unequal. So in other words, just the fact of property is, I mean, it's going to be inequality. The great masses, therefore, which excite envy and tempt rapacity, must be put out of the possibility of danger by being excluded from the representative body. They then form a natural rampart. This is beginning to sound like a Monty Python sketch. A natural rampart about the lesser properties in all their gradations. The same quantity of property, which is by the natural course of things divided among many, has not the same operation. The plunder of a few would indeed give but a share. So it's of no use to take what the rich have and divide it up among the many. It wouldn't give them much. The power of perpetuating our property in our families is one of the most valuable and interesting circumstances belonging to it, and that which tends the most to the perpetuation of society itself. This is what I was thinking of, which I thought was odd and interesting. It makes our weakness subservient to our virtue. It grafts benevolence even upon avarice. The possessors of family wealth and of the distinction which attends hereditary possession, as most concerned in it, are the natural securities for this transmission.
I hope the listeners, as they listen to all these long quotes, get a sense of how painfully difficult it is to read this.
How syntactically lush is the...
Syntactically lush. Nice. That's a nice way of putting it.
It's a phrase Burke might have used himself.
Yeah, I had a lot of difficulty reading it. I actually just listened to the entire book, including the really boring parts that we didn't formally assign as an audio book. And then when I went back to take notes, for part of it, I actually still played the audiobook while following along with my eyes, so that my brain did not have to actually stop at every sentence. And then I would just stop and take notes or copy things out.
It helps if you put on like a pair of tights and like a white wig.
And dust yourself with privilege.
Yes, it all becomes much, much clearer.
That the audiobook, even at double speed and read by the person who's not that great, who reads the LibriVox recording in this case, that it was all very understandable. I barely ever had to kind of skip back and like, what did that sentence mean? So despite the syntactic density, I feel like it is mellifluous in a certain way.
I just imagine Patrick Stewart reading it to me.
He's repetitive enough that...
He could have used a good editor.
Editor. Yeah. A bad editor would have been helpful.
I don't know. No, I like this kind of writing.
It's too long.
It is. You're right. It could. You're right. This could have been boiled down to a blog post. No, not a blog post.
No, it could have been made a third the length, a good 80 or 90 page essay. Easy.
No, even less.
And there are, you know, we could have read an excerption of this because some of the parts that we didn't read are very obviously because they're like, now I'm going to in detail criticize the monetary policy of the new French government. Now I'm going to criticize the judiciary that they've proposed of how they're going to do, like going through in painstaking detail. No, that's not relevant to us. We just let it pass. However, at the time, it was probably a fine level of detail.
Well, it was like a bestseller, right? It was a huge selling book.
Yep.
One of the things that I think is interesting about the legacy of this thing is that I was under the impression that Burke is somehow an ideological pillar of conservatism.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the people who reach canonical status like that get reprints. They get some kind of, like, you can find decent editions of Hayek or other conservative theorists. Every online copy, Kindle version, they're all weak. So just so you know, Wes gave us a link to which archive is like of the University of
archive.org,
but it's a university copy or something like that. Anyway, the Kindle version, which at least doesn't have the use of the letter F instead of S, you know, like all that old school, old English stuff, you can't search in it. Search is not enabled for this copy. So you have a 300-page political document you cannot search. If you try to read this thing on an iPad with these sentences that he writes and these insane paragraphs, it's like almost unreadable. And I would have thought if this was such a critical work of theory that underpins modern political movements, that somebody would have taken the time to try to make something authoritative that would be useful to us. Off/rant.
Well, I think these things have been passed down. The non-searchability, it's part of the tradition.
You haven't gotten the scroll edition.
It'll Seth. Make you a better man, Seth.
Oh, yeah. Those days are over.
So since we just talked about how it's okay that there are rich people compared to poor people, and that the poor people should be protected from...
Hereditarily rich people.
Yes.
He has very little to say about people who come up through merchant class and all that kind of stuff.
Pretty much very close after that, page 44, I have, for though hereditary wealth and rank, and the rank which goes with it, are too much idolized by creeping sycophants and the blind, abject admirers of power, they are too rashly slighted in shallow speculations of the petulant, assuming short-sighted coxcombs of philosophy. Some decent regulated preeminence, some preference, not exclusive approbation, given to birth is neither unusual nor unjust nor impolitic. So with a few caveats, it's okay that there are some people that are lords, that there's an aristocracy.
And the idea here is not that God has ordained it thus, it's just that it's for the benefit of the whole. And the way there, you know, there's a heart and a liver and a pancreas, some of us have to be the pancreas. It serves the functioning of the whole state. I think that's the general idea of the way you would justify something like this.
Don't you mean somebody has to be the rectum?
Yes. Sorry. Okay.
I just wanted you to come up with the... Somebody has to be the toenail, right? Somebody has to be the toe fungus.
Now you guys are going back to Hobbes.
I thought I was a little farther north of the rectum, but...
Okay.
I'm somewhere, yeah.
Right after that, it says, it is said that 24 millions ought to prevail over 200,000... True, if the constitution of a kingdom be a problem of arithmetic. This sort of discourse does well enough with the lamppost for its second. To men who may reason calmly, it is ridiculous. I'm not sure what having the lamppost as my second.
The lamppost for its second is the threat of hanging, is what that means.
Yeah.
Ah, okay. Thank you. The will of the many and their interest must very often differ, and great will be the difference when they make an evil choice. Government of 500 county attorneys and obscure curates is not good for 24 millions of men, though we're chosen by 8 and 40 millions. So in other words, you're always going to have, just as a practical matter, some representative body actually getting things done. And so wouldn't it be good if those people have some sort of qualifications, have some sort of even upbringing to do this kind of thing? So that, in other words, training more or less since birth, the education to do this. You know, of course, we have to keep in mind the common people of his time were way, way less educated. And I think that's kind of the key thing that unravels all of this is that we have made the choice. We are going with democracy here. And so we have to deal with the electorate that we have, and we have to just commit to educating them, to all of us being educated and improving the communications. So it really isn't that a small representative body is just making the decisions with no possibility of any influence by us. Like, you know, now we have all this communication and stuff.
I think it's not just education, though. When I was reading through this, I was thinking, well, how do I capture what he's trying to get at here? And I think it's like leadership ability, leadership qualities, which he associates with being part of the nobility, I think.
You think just to vote in the assembly, you need leadership qualities?
No, I think that he means the idea that the nobility have as part of their ethic, that they are supposed to be leaders. And so there's a cultivation within that class of habits and mores and dispositions to be leaders. That's the conceit.
Yeah. So for instance, on page 42 of my edition, he says, the lawyers who are in the assembly are not the glory of the bar, but the greater part, the inferior, unlearned, mechanical, merely instrumental members of the profession. Instrumental as in people who follow orders. And later on, he's going to basically suggest that you need people who are actually in a position to be not the instrumental members of a society, not the people who are given the orders, but who are giving the orders. And not only that, but who are conscious of their position. There's something about here what Nietzsche calls the pathos of distance. Just the feeling of being superior to other people is actually a qualification for being superior to other people. So he says, you know, he talks of the body being placed in the hands of men not taught habitually to respect themselves, who had no previous fortune in character at stake, who could not be expected to bear with moderation or to conduct with discretion a power, dot, dot, dot. So there's something about being qualified to use power.
The criticism he's making there is of the National Assembly. So he's talking about the post-revolution French National Assembly as being full of non-leaders, essentially. The people who would be mere mechanics of government, the lowest of the curates, and that's a problem.
Men formed to be instruments, not controls, not habituated to sentiments of dignity. A lot of this, again, goes back to people who are not part of the landed interest.
I'm trying to find a way to engage with this in kind of a rational manner. But it just so much of this stuff is, I get a violent reaction to it. What he doesn't give a sufficient account for is two things. One is that the tradition which structures the society has to have a mechanism for change that's tied to this notion of rights that are supposed to be insured by the landed class or whatever. And there's this idea that, well, you have to trust in the mechanism of the nobility or the monarchy or the parliament to address these concerns. And if not, if they aren't addressed, then you have to just be patient, right? And it reminded me of the letter from a Birmingham jail. Do you guys remember having that conversation about ML King's? And he says, you know, one of the basic points in your statement is that the action and I and my associates have taken in Birmingham is untimely. And he says, hey, we've waited for more than 340 years for our constitutional and God-given rights. And he's basically saying, we do not want and we cannot permit violent overthrow because of the terror and the violations that will occur. But he's saying, it's okay to continue to perpetuate oppression and the terror and the violence that's inherent in the system, because that's somehow less objectionable or there's less of a degree to it than what happens when there's chaos. And again, I keep coming back to the idea that this is an argument that could only be made by somebody who benefits from that inherent structure. And at the same time, I'm sympathetic to, it just feels like he's reacting to one thing, but he's lining up all of these unsupportable arguments against it when he could have taken a very different approach. He's justifying institutions that don't deserve justification simply in response to what he sees as a threat or a fear of something that might happen in England.
Does it matter that he saw this threat of chaos that seems like it got borne out, right, in the terror, which happened after he wrote this,
right?
So on the face of it, he saw elements that led to a weak government that had tendencies of tyranny and terror, and that just ended up being borne out wholly.
And he does talk frequently about the possibility of both revolution, but then non-revolutionary reform. You go back to that whole wounds of the father quote, You should approach to the faults of the state as to the wounds of the father instead of simply ripping the father apart, which is kind of seems consistent with King's approach, right? The nonviolent, peaceful protest, persuading the law rather than trying to step outside of it.
We did read that section from early on in the essay where he says, terrible outcomes in the short term may have positive outcomes in the long term. And positive outcomes in the short term may have terrible outcomes in the long term. He makes a claim about not being able to judge the efficacy or the outcome of actions. We don't have that ability to do that. Do you guys remember anything like that?
Yep, that's right before the section I just read, actually.
Okay.
The science of jurisprudence.
So, yes, he predicted that there would be the terrors and this disruption of the French Revolution. And in fact, his prediction was borne out. But if we look at it from the perspective of where we sit now, if the four of us said, okay, let's take a look at the state of France now versus if we did a hypothetical about what France would be like now if there had not been the French Revolution, or for that matter, if America had not had the American Revolution. Do we look at that and say unequivocally that the outcome of the French Revolution was bad? Was there terror? Was there disruption? Yes.
Not to mention Napoleon romping around Europe and
yeah.
We're a bunch of atheists that, you know, according to his take, that was the big long-term thing, is that atheism ended up more or less winning, or at least gaining a much...
And the metric system, Seth, the metric system.
Bon Dieu.
Well, if you say that without the French Revolution, there would never have been Napoleon, then maybe my argument goes out the window. But this entire thing is, in many respects, his attempt to caution people against being infatuated with what happened in France and taking the same action in England, to the extent that he doesn't want to appeal to absolute claims or theories or reason or grounding principles. There's a sense in which this truly is just a piece of rhetoric to say, I am going to try and convince you Englishmen, not Americans, not Frenchmen, not Spaniards, not anything. I'm trying to convince the English people not to use the French as a model, because yes, he's making predictions about what will happen to the French during the revolution, but ultimately all he's really trying to do is say the same sort of thing that would happen in England would be a disaster.
France had much, much different problems at that time than England, and that, like, financial insolvency was really one of the big ones, which led to the French Revolution. But it also didn't have the history that England had of this robust parliamentary counterweight to kingly authority. So I'm not sure that he's worried about revolution in England. The revolution, in a sense, has already happened. I think he's worried about, and we get this towards the end of our reading, he's worried about the corrosive effect of these ideas, the way in which they could undermine the good things that England already has. You know, at one point he says, just the very idea of rights is actually corrosive to liberty, ironically enough. And liberty, by the way, is sort of his overall prevailing standard. This isn't something we've mentioned yet, because I vaguely said, well, you know, the sort of the overarching standard here for his argument is good consequences and bad consequences. But the way the reading starts, he talks about being a lover of liberty, and liberty ends up being something inherited, and society ends up being for the sake of liberty. And so that's the ultimate thing that must be safeguarded. The main point here is, I think he's worried about ideas, the effect of certain ideas on the fabric of English society, not that England is going to imitate the French Revolution. Maybe I'm wrong about that. That's just the sense I get from the reading itself. These sermons, you know, in the old Jewry, these Marxist professors corrupting the youth.
So the whole take on the social contract here that we got a while ago of being necessity, I read this as straight up that he took Aristotle seriously, that we are social animals. And so by our very nature, it is our good, it is our telos to be in these associations. And just like Aristotle, that's that some people are naturally slaves. Some people, the best thing for them, according to Burke, is to be in the low rung of this association. And it's still much better for them to be in the low rung of this association than to be a rebel against the association itself. And then taking from that, there's a quote here on 52, you know, why he doesn't like the idea of metaphysic rights is because those don't accurately describe what our telos would be about, what excellence. So he says these metaphysic rights entering into common life, like rays of light which pierce into a dense medium, are by the laws of nature refracted from their straight line. Indeed, in the gross and complicated mass of human passions and concerns, the primitive rights of men undergo such a variety of refractions and reflections that it becomes absurd to talk of them as if they continued in the simplicity of their original direction. And later he says, the simple governments are fundamentally defective, to say no worse of them. So I think he's just trying to get at the complexity of what the human telos and then what it is for the compact to be optimal is just defies this, like, no, everyone has the right to food. Everyone has the right to any sort of spelling out. Like, no, the rights are always going to be dependent on the exact circumstances of the society. What else did you guys make of this whole straight line thing?
So right after that, there's another great line in the next paragraph. The pretended rights of these theorists are all extremes, and in proportion as they are metaphysically true, they are morally and politically false. The rights of men are in a sort of middle, incapable of definition, but not impossible to be discerned. The rights of men in governments are their advantages, and these are often in balances between differences in good, in compromises, sometimes between good and evil, and sometimes between evil and evil. Political reason is a computing principle, adding, subtracting, multiplying, and dividing, morally and not metaphysically or mathematically, true moral denominations. So it's just the sense in which the abstract notion of rights doesn't do justice to all the sorts of compromises we have to make practically when we're making decisions. And if we are hardliners about those rights, this could almost, again, come down to what de Beauvoir calls the serious, right? We might be willing to sacrifice everything to the concept of right, right? We might be, no matter how terrible things get, no matter how much terror there is, no matter how much, well, this is a matter of rights, and we must enforce that, and there's no compromise. That's a drawback, is treating rights as sort of extreme metaphysical principles that are inviolable.
Gun laws, anyone? I have the right to my firearm. It doesn't matter how bad things get, how many people are murdered, how much gun violence there is. Like, that's the right. This is exactly the kind of example I think that he's talking about. Once you buy into abstract rights, they take over. They prevent you from actually doing good governance. You need a more pragmatic approach to overall well-being.
Just one note here, the Bill of Rights that came with the Glorious Revolution that Burke supports includes the right to bear arms. It's sort of one of the origins of in the American Bill of Rights. So,
yeah. But part of the Second Amendment and the troubles with that have to do with the interpretation, right? All of the rights that are outlined in the Bill of Rights, at least in the American Constitution, have limits on them.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you bring up this because historically it really is about giving you the capacity for revolution. That's really what that right is about in English common law and in American law. So it's about making sure that at any given time we can overthrow the government.
But that might be a matter for another discussion, right? I know that people interpret it that way. It doesn't seem so clear to me by reading like the three sentences there that that's what it really means.
There's a huge scholarly dispute. I did my own research on this. It seemed pretty clear to me. And especially in English common law, it's clear because they state it expressly.
Or just imagine if somebody's arguing for an absolute right of privacy. And so, like, no, I can't let you into the terrorist phone, that kind of thing. That Burke would be a pragmatist about individual things like that. Yes, we would want privacy to be an expectation as an overall part of our well-being. However, when it comes down to it, none of these things are absolute.
There are limits on free speech, which are already well embedded in American law. There are many, many limits on free speech. The most famous one, of course, is the yelling fire in a crowded theater, incitements, you know, things like that, fighting words.
But there's also going to be another line, right, where the rule of law in the sense of following those rules are part of the administration of justice. So something like a Miranda rule. Or whatever, so that the case where you know the person is guilty, but because the evidence against them was obtained illegally, then they're not found guilty by the law because the evidence is inadmissible because the rules were broken. There are good reasons for having rules go in both those directions.
If we come at it from the other direction, it could be, yes, we're going to torture this person.
Yes.
And not give them due process. We can sacrifice rights for the sake of security. It's a tough question, and Burke even acknowledges this at some point.
Right. It's something that is worked out by experience, I think, over time. Like, that's the value of tradition, is because something has been honed over time, that we've worked out what are the limits on free speech through a series of conflicts and end up tweaking the exact rules to something that seems to work best. And maybe as circumstances change, what seems best, you know, if terrorism gets much, much more frequent, then maybe we change our expectations about privacy. We kind of have the feeling like, well, if you allow torture in this one case, then we're lawless. Like, we're lawless in the way that Burke would object to. It's because, okay, now they'll just torture all the time. But if the where you allow torture were, not that I think you should allow torture ever anyway, but if this were the kind of thing that had the no torture rule was like the free speech rule, that, well, okay, there are exceptions in certain circumstances, you could figure out as you go forward what those circumstances should be. And as long as people are actually paying attention to the rules, and perhaps there has to be transparency, you can't have groups shielded from public eye making these decisions, because then what is going to connect them to the tradition? Certainly not their code of ethics, not their religion.
The circumstances you're describing, Mark, those exceptions seem to be impossible to codify into law. They're the kinds of things that you would have to leave up. They would be part of the prudential activities of the appropriately experienced and smart people that Burke wants to have running government. So there'd be this whole category of judgments that are made that are pseudo-judicial or extrajudicial, right? Where you would never codify them and probably never have the kind of transparency you're talking about, but they are the politic judgments based upon circumstance of the appropriately experienced people.
Like a star chamber. Sorry.
Like a star chamber.
There's a reference.
I'm sorry. You guys are beginning to scare me with this line of talk.
I think what I'm saying would be a very Burkean kind of thing to say.
Okay.
Right? That you would have all these pragmatic decisions that would be one-offs, right? But you could never codify such a thing into law.
It's interesting exploring Burke's whole thinking here, because we had in our Federalist Papers and our discussion, if you learn anything about the Constitution, just the fundamental assumption is that there is going to be abuse and we just have to construct the system so that abuse will be checked. I'm trying to figure out the extent to which Burke buys that. Like, it seems that no, he thinks that, yes, of course, there is going to be abuse in individual circumstances, but you don't construct the whole picture with the chief purpose of preventing abuse.
Checks and balances aren't.
You assume that most people are going to be doing what they're supposed to be doing, again, because we have these non-governmental customs, we have religion built into the government, we have all these moral aspects of a moral compass that are sort of built into it, so you don't need the degree of paranoia in the construction of checks and balances.
When he's defending the Glorious Revolution, one of the things he valorizes about that is that basically they set up some checks and balances, like the parliament is a check on the king.
But not such that the king can be impeached. It's not that kind of...
He explicitly, let me just read you the rule laid down for the government in the Declaration of Right, the constant inspection of parliament, the practical claim of impeachment... They thought infinitely better security, not only for their constitutional liberty, blah, blah, blah. So there is a impeachment clause in there. I don't know enough about it to know how that works exactly and whether that's specifically towards the king. But
it seems like it can't possibly be towards the king, given the other stuff that he says. Right? How could you impeach a king? And even the way he defends it.
Yeah, I'm not sure how impeachment works exactly, but the parliament is a counterbalance to the monarch. There's no doubt about that.
I'm probably even overstating. Yes, it's in the text of the Constitution and, you know, worrying about checks and balances and things. In other words, trying to put everything into law that you have to obey so that you don't rely on the judgment of individuals. You don't rely on them being wise or virtuous in order to prevent things from going wrong. But we've seen even recently in the operation of the government, like all these kind of Senate rules, these traditions, such that then we're going to pursue the nuclear option. There's a lot of things that are not strictly rules, but that are just procedures of this is the way we've always done it. And so then when a president or some party in the Senate violates this thing, then it's like, oh my God, when somebody says, I'm going to trash the system. You know, when Trump says he's going to ignore sort of all the gentlemen's agreements that are built in, I'm going to play a hardball with these people in a way that even though we've had antagonistic parties before, they've never played hardball like this against each other. I'm going to really play a hardball.
I want to correct this. So the impeachment thing, it's a clause about, it's a freedom of speech clause. It's actually members of parliament can't be prosecuted in court for anything they say in the debates in parliament.
Huh.
It's preventing parliament from being impeached, essentially, or the parliamentary debates.
Hey, let's stop for just a second to talk about our sponsor.
For those suffering with an addiction problem who have unsuccessfully attended treatment, there is hope. The National Institute on Drug Abuse claims there is no single treatment option that is right for everyone and that treatment should address the multiple needs of an individual and not just the drug use. Recovery should move beyond coping with addiction to helping people thrive. Gulf Breeze Recovery's Thrive program is a holistic non-12-step treatment system that not only treats the true underlying cause of the addiction, but also addresses the individual's physical, spiritual, and mental needs. Gulf Breeze Recovery helps people discover a fresh new outlook on life that enables them to be captains of their own ship. The waterfront facility is neat, clean, comfortable, offers private and semi-private rooms, a lighted fishing pier, and a large swimming pool overlooking the water. You can view the webcam, take a virtual tour, and get more information at gulfbreezerecovery.com or call 855-9-HOLISTIC-REHAB.
The last part that we quoted was from like 52, 53 about how government is a computing principle. This is all in the context of him railing against people that want to use revolution instead of reform. Page 54, these professors, finding their extreme principles not applicable to cases which call only for a qualified, or as I may say, civil and legal resistance, in such cases employ no resistance at all. It is with them a war or a revolution, or it is nothing. Finding their schemes of politics not adapted to the state of the world in which they live, they often come to think lightly of all public principle. This, I wrote Bernie next to it, because I feel like people who are idealists, in fact, he even says later on the page, they have some change in the church or state or both constantly in their view. When that is the case, they are always bad citizens and perfectly unsure connections. For considering their speculative designs as of infinite value and the actual arrangement of the state as of no estimation, they are at best indifferent about it. They see no merit in the good and no fault in the vicious management of public affairs. They rather rejoice in the latter as more propitious to revolution.
So they have their mind set on this ideal, and anything but that becomes of no interest. So gradual reform and being pragmatic and compromising, that all becomes tedious. Even if someone horrible comes along or threatens to come into power, even that can become a matter of indifference because it might lead to the sort of societal breakdown, which will lead to the revolution they really want and establishing the ideal state on top of that or something like that. And he goes on to say that this focus on the ideal ultimately perverts people's capacity for empathy.
Sure.
Just after what you read, Mark.
Yeah, specifically if they're all girded for violent revolution. But as these occasions may never arise where they need to use violence, the mind receives a gratuitous taint. And the moral sentiments suffer not a little when no political purpose is served by the deprivation, which seems a little less relevant to our politics now. But I guess that does, if you are, for instance, a hard right militia person, or really just anybody that feels like maybe there are leftists that are like this. Like if the person I don't like gets elected, there's going to be a revolution. I might participate in that. I just heard an interview on NPR with a Trump supporter that actually said that.
Yes.
That if Hillary wins, there's going to be. Something's going to go down. Not that he was necessarily going to initiate it.
People on both sides have been saying that kind of thing forever.
Yes, exactly. Mm.
It's not a simple equality. It's far too facile.
I think it's more equal than our side is willing to admit.
We just threatened to move to Canada. We don't.
That's a political debate to have another time. But this whole general idea of perverting one's capacity for empathy, or the way he puts it, they have perverted in themselves and in those who attend to them all the well-placed sympathies of the human breast, in part because they get so taken up with rights. This, again, is the specter of the serious, where most violence, you know, this is one of the interesting things lately I've seen in some books that have come out by sociologists, but violence is generally moralized, right? People are most prone to doing brutal things when they think they know the ultimate good.
It's a righteous action.
Yeah. So when you're this righteous, when you know what the rights are and there's no compromising and blah, 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 then I think he's right. There is inevitably that effect on empathy because actual individual human beings become less important than those abstract ideals and are to be crushed underneath their boot. They can be sacrificed for the sake of those ideals.
I think you're right. That's the danger. But in a funny way, sacrificing oneself to those ideals is also the glory, right? That's where the sacrificing oneself or one's life for, be it the idea of freedom or your country or the rule of law or any of these other ideas. I mean, especially something like democracy is founded on an idea. And the interesting thing being pointed out is that you can be associated with a terrible idea or a really good idea.
Ultimately, all ideas are really terrible when they become more important than flesh and blood human beings.
Oh, that's not true at all.
What do you mean it's not true at all?
What is the quote from Martin Luther King? What are you willing to die for, right? But I think the difference is the choice that one makes to sacrifice one's life for an idea versus sacrificing other people's lives for that idea. That is, to me, a kind of clarification of where that line is.
Right.
I mean, we'd have to ask Burke, well, what about conscription? What about like different things that were going on? It seems like he thinks that the power of ideas is an essential part. Like I was saying, you can't have just written laws. You have to have a culture of ethical norms and things that supports that. And part of that culture is that the goodness of the society has to be embodied in the person of the king. That's part of what he thinks is awesome, that it makes us revere, worship society itself. So in that case, yeah, that's an idea. Tradition, God, country, those are ideas that he thinks you could legitimately not only die for, but send other people in a battle off to die for, or potentially, I mean, he doesn't want to go in and kill unjustly, but it seems like there are lots of, depending on how bad things get, there might be lots of sacrifices that are not just of yourself that get justified by these ideas.
Yeah, each side in this debate can always accuse the other of sacrificing people to ideas. But ultimately, he thinks, though, that his sort of ultimate standard is, again, consequences. It's the good of society or something like that. Whereas the idea of abstract rights is inherently non-consequentialist. So the example we gave in the Singer episode is, you know, this whole classic utilitarian dilemma between flipping a train switch to have it go kill one person lying on the tracks versus five people on the tracks. And then one level you could make that from a consequentialist point of view, it's obvious that you send it to kill the one person. But from a rights-based point of view, each life is sort of an infinite value and the calculation breaks down. So it is two different modes of rights-based reasoning versus consequentialism is two very different ways of thinking about these things. So then the task is to explore, can each one be rigid in a way? Can each one lead to atrocities and sacrifices when taken to an extreme? And probably the answer is yes.
However, that's also an example of a prejudice we have that, you know, you shouldn't intentionally do wrong. That was at least one of the things that when we were talking with Singer, that what is rational, according to him, the law of utility, everybody's interest is equal, is not the thing we are prejudiced to do, is not the thing that is a natural sentiment for us. And he very much argues, so here's on page 72, he's talking about prejudices. The context of this whole section is he's saying why he doesn't think that these ideas that caught on in France will catch on in England because of the English character. That earlier he says, we think that we are not the converts of Rousseau. We are not the disciples of Voltaire. Atheists are not our preacher. Madmen are not our lawgivers. We know we have made no discoveries, and we think that no discoveries are to be made in morality, nor many in the great principles of government, nor in the ideas of liberty, which were understood long before we were born.
Yes, good temperate Englishman.
In England, we have...
Does this validate my concern that that was the thrust of this, was to caution the English against?
In England, we have not yet been completely embowelled of our natural entrails. We still feel within... Yeah, this is one of my favorite lines. We still feel within us, and we cherish and cultivate those inbred sentiments, not to mention inbred royalty, which are the faithful guardians, the active monitors of our duty, the true supporters of all liberal and manly morals. Which is not the only time he uses the word manly.
Lots of manly.
We have not been drawn in trust in order that we may be filled like stuffed birds in a museum with chaff and rags and paltry blurred shreds of paper about the rights of men.
We're English, not French.
The gist of this argument towards the end of our reading is it's about the sense in which the passions, and later on they also talk about the passions instructing reason. It's about the feasibility of reason or the frailty of reason and the necessity for sentiment and attachment and passion and these sorts of things, particularly attachment to tradition, of course, to play a role in our political decision making.
Yes, the quote that I was actually edging toward there was about prejudice in particular. Instead of casting away all our old prejudices, we, the English, cherish them to a very considerable degree. And to take more shame to ourselves, we cherish them because they are prejudices. And the longer they have lasted and the more generally they have prevailed, the more we cherish them. We are afraid to put men to live and trade each on his own private stock of reason because we suspect that this stock in each man is small and that the individuals would do better to avail themselves of the bank and capital of nations and of ages.
This made me think of Ricoeur, this passage. The importance of...
Explain, name dropper.
Well, I only vaguely... This is like what's so terrible about these podcasts is how quickly I forget. Within like the week after we've recorded it, I completely forget, and I didn't look this up. But the sense in which our interpretative project begins with prejudices, and we can't simply pretend that we can cast them away and sort of look at things from a bird's eye point of view. So in other words, it's analogous to the whole idea of being reformers instead of revolutionaries. Our hermeneutic predicament is that we can't really be revolutionaries. That's the same hermeneutic version of our political predicament.
Well, saying that we are doomed in some ways to start with the prejudices that we have and actively priding yourselves and trying to cling to them, those seem different heuristic tools.
Except that there are so many other passages in this in which he's open to reform. So we really should not paint a picture of him where he's opposed to reform and he's completely opposed even to revolution, because it's just not accurate.
And he's probably not using the term prejudice in the way that we would use it. No matter how many smart minorities I see, my prejudice is that they're all lazy, dumb bastards, and I'm going to cling to them. No.
Prejudgment, assumption, the sort of things that Aristotle was talking about in our Nicomachean Ethics reading, the principles that only nous can get at, the things that can't be proven.
It's not a pan to bigotry.
What if we just interpret that in terms of the earlier quote, we think that no discoveries are to be made in morality, nor many in the great principles of government.
Well, that's like Aristotle saying they cannot be the conclusions of demonstrative arguments.
Where does then Peter Singer's claim about universality, which again goes against our native prejudices, where does that lie? Because that's exactly the kind of thing that he says that Noose would discover, that Singer says, that reason itself discovers. It's a discovery made in morality. It's one made perennial. It's not a recent discovery, but it's not one that controls societies. There's almost no society actually based on that principle, that the in-groups and the out-groups get equal treatment. You can't have a society based on that.
Well, the law tends towards that, right? I mean, one might even think the whole point of the law is to prevent revenge-based in-group, out-group antagonism, an eye for an eye sort of thing, right? So instead of us all being mafiosos and enforcing justice for our families the way we see fit, if someone kills someone I love, it goes to the courts. That's the sense in which the law embodies the impartiality that Singer is talking about.
Thank you, Athena.
But your question still stands. Like, do we really think there are no discoveries in morality? Or
I just had the crude picture of purely property redistribution in terms of a government. If you distinguish between citizens and non-citizens, then you can collect tax from everybody and you can spend it on all the citizens through various things. And maybe you could be very egalitarian about it. But if you said, even though we, the government, were only elected by this part of the people, we're not going to distinguish between citizens and non-citizens, or people within our borders or without our borders, then we have to equally distribute all the stuff we collect over everyone in the world. And it would, you know, this is the thing that people afraid of the extreme liberal welfare state think might really happen. We're just going to give away everything.
Right. We either have a country or we don't have a country. Sorry.
Gotta be bastard.
That's a quote from Donald Trump.
Any other threads people want to pull at here? What about the end? This is page 203. What is liberty without wisdom, without virtue? It is the greatest of possible evils, for it is folly, vice, and madness without tuition or restraint. To make a government requires no great prudence. Settle the seat of power, teach obedience, and the work is done. To give freedom is still more easy. It is not necessary to guide, it only requires to let go of the rein. But to form a free government, that is to temper these opposite elements of liberty and restraint in one consistent work, requires much thought, deep reflection, a sagacious, powerful, and combining mind. There you go.
I like Burke.
Elaborate.
Oh, I know Seth is horrified by him. Well, I remember, it's interesting, I read him, the last time I read this was at the University of Texas it was sort of one of my electives at grad school there. So it was a sort of an upper level undergraduate course. And the professor who's running it basically made Burke into this foil idiotic. Basically, it was completely idiotic and stupid, and he just shit all over it for the whole class. And I found myself raising my hand to defend Burke because I thought it was unfair until he got fed up with that. I didn't want to hear from me anymore. So despite my sort of sympathy for deontology, for the concept of rights, and my natural distaste for consequentialism, which has probably come across in a few podcasts, and the typical American disdain for monarchy and nobility and the rich and all the things, you know, it's interesting to see this kind of defense of that. So, I mean, who today would write something like this defending this, right? And of course, there are a lot of profound and interesting truths to be gleaned from it, whatever your politics. But the thing that continues to be most interesting to me is this question that was raised in the Crito and continued here about when disobedience to the law is legitimate, when revolution is legitimate, and the implications of that, not just for politics, but it's a question we can even ask about ourselves, because we could treat ourselves, our psyches, on the classic analogy, as sort of mini political systems. How do we change? So that's really the fundamental question. It's a question about becoming. It's a question about change and moral and political. And so I think it's fascinating in that sense to me. That's my closing.
Some of what he says in the abstract, I like the idea of favoring the concrete over the abstract, of being too willing to make substantial sacrifices of real people's blood, sweat, and tears for an ideal, for an abstract thing that you just came up with. I completely get that. And even the pictures he outlines of how mean it was in France for them to just think, if you're a nobleman or a clergyman in that society, and like, you've obeyed the rules your whole life and you've done what you think you're going to do. And then everything just changes on you and they just take your stuff and they kick you out. And the whole thing you trained for your life, you don't get to do. That's not very nice. And you better have a damn good reason if you're going to actually do that to people. You better be sure as much as you can be of that that sacrifice will not be in vain. I'm glad that violent revolution is not on the table among our realistic political options among sane people anymore. And if that is the point here, then great. But so much of the rest of what he has to say, so much of the underlying, unless you have religion strapped to the political, then things are going to be terrible. Then people aren't going to obey. And people are naturally unequal, not because only the people born of noble houses are worthy to govern, but that's still more true than not. You know, just this fundamental, we've put all our eggs in the egalitarianism basket, and I'm comfortable with that. I don't see how it's possibly defensible to go the other direction. You know, if I really was going to judge him, I'd have to see, even though he's talking about very specific things in his day, we don't know those things well enough to know whether we would agree with him about these things. We would have to just read other authors from this time that also sound reasonable. Maybe we'll read some Mary Wollstonecraft, I know, is one of the ones on our list. Apparently was very shocked by Burke's views here about natural rights. And I certainly take Seth's point that he keeps bringing up about those who are not benefited by the current system could not possibly have this view. And so I can certainly see people in the modern age trying to be Burkeans and themselves advocating politically conservative things that would disgust me.
We should say here, Burke is considered the father of political conservatism as we know it. I don't think we said that up to this point. So this is for intellectual conservatives. This is one of the classic figures to which they look for.
Which is why I would have expected that there would be an easier to read and more authoritative version out there.
Apparently he's more quoted than read. And that was even true like 50 years after he died, according to the intro of the book that I have that was from like 1940 or something.
If it was possible for us to do our podcast on quotes instead of readings, then I certainly would have in this case, and also for Husserl.
See, I like this kind of prose, the ornateness.
Yeah. This kind of purple prose.
Yeah.
There's times where it was pretty awesome. I really like him as a pragmatic advocate for politics and for government, especially if I kind of close my eyes during the sections of rabidly supporting monarchy, because it seemed to be in large part about the notion of pragmatic government. And there seemed to be a lot of virtue there to me. What I found myself just chomping at the bit was just his sort of sanguine attitude towards the location of power and where it is, and that that's just naturally the way it is, and there aren't things that are going to change that. And frankly, his lack of thoughtfulness about what the sources of some of those discrepancies are. Like, for instance, saying that there's all kinds of reasons why common everyday people can't possibly lead the country. Maybe if there was more education amongst people and that there was more equality of certain sorts, that that would help alleviate this kind of thing. It's not even part of his vocabulary or part of the conversation at all. And it's not clear to me that it couldn't have been. So I just find that it tweaks a lot of my anti-authoritarian, anti-nobility American kind of sentiments. I find myself more enamored of something like the Federalist Papers about the way to think about government and good government and the construction of it.
What you just said there, Dylan, reminded me that this is a good lead-in to our de Tocqueville reading, because one way to read Burke's argument here is that our egalitarianism can actually be a threat to our liberty. You know, this is one of the things that Burke says repeatedly, that society as it's structured, as it safeguards liberty, even when there's inequality. And de Tocqueville is going to explore the same idea, that there's a tension between freedom and equality.
Yeah, that'll be a good discussion. We can elaborate more about the nature of that tension and maybe reflect on where Burke ended up on that.
So yes, folks should already be aware that our next reading is Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. It was a Partially Examined Life live show that will have already happened by the time you're hearing this. Seth, anything else to take us home? You have more closing?
I guess I'll just say I listened to a comment and said that, you know, Burke was a conservative in the true sense of the word. His goal was to conserve as much as he could with the minimal amount of change. That's kind of the true nature, that his whole project was stability and avoidance of this terror and tumult and the things that he saw that were awful about. And the two things I would say about that are, first, that that is, in many respects, it's operating from a place of fear. So it's a reaction to the fear of a potential future outcome. And so this conservatism that he introduces is really about preserving the status quo, because it's something that you know versus the thing that you fear, which is something that you don't know. And that knowing of this current state, which makes it familiar and comfortable, versus the fear of the unknown, is to be juxtaposed with the knowing of the current state of the people who, again, I'm beating the drum, but for whom the status quo is not worse than the alternative. And he shows remarkably little compassion or imagination for any motivation that might drive somebody to say, whatever the unknown is, it's got to be better than the situation as it stands. And it also not taking into account the long patience of people who perhaps have tried to change, or the mechanisms, understanding the mechanisms that are available for change. And it's this notion of patient enlightenment, waiting for the people who have the power to make change in a society to become enlightened about the plight of others or whatever. And so the whole thing struck me. I mean, I wanted to be, you know, that I'm the generous reader, right? I'm the guy who tries to give everybody the benefit of the doubt. But in this case, I really struggled to do that. So I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, it was only really going back and taking notes on this that I wasn't just thinking the whole time, like, this is just more shit. Like,
it's amazing how, like, I'm completely did not have that reaction.
Yeah, and I didn't want to be the modern liberal guy, like, reacting to this.
I just step into a different frame of mind and enjoy, maybe it's perversely, the word is perverse, perversely enjoy the elitism of it without necessarily endorsing it, but I can enjoy it.
We've read many other things that advocate politically a conservative position that I took that position to much more than this. So, but I think it might be interesting too. I think the discussions about Burke and his context and the reaction to this publication, amongst other things, are actually much more interesting than a discussion about this particular text itself. I mean, it seems like a lot of people talk about the Paine-Burke debates, talking about Thomas Paine. Very few people seem to reference Wollstonecraft. But there was clearly a very strong and violent response to this, which in itself is an endorsement that we should respect it.
This also served to just dispel the appeal of Aristotle's politics, because Aristotle's just so abstract. This is, folks can look back to the politics episode on this. But since I was just interpreting this whole thing in terms of taking Aristotle seriously, then when you read Aristotle, like, oh yeah, an aristocracy in the abstract, if you could figure out who the best people were and put them in charge, wouldn't you rather have the best people, the qualified people in charge? Like, well, okay, people actually did feel like they were taking that seriously through a good chunk of history, and I don't like it. I like our way better.
You haven't tried the other way, Mark. Don't knock it until you try.
I traditionally, through my ancestors, I tried it. I think they probably liked it just fine.
Well, the point is, yes, we like our way better, but we have also lost something, and I think we shouldn't forget that. We shouldn't pretend that there are no trade-offs. There are benefits to the old system. We've gained a lot of things, but we've also lost something.
I'm happy to say goodbye and adios, farewell to the old system, but I think that we should remember that the system we have now, at least in the U.S. and other similar countries, relies on a lot of contingent facts about the nature of our communities, in particular things like education and the availability and breadth of education that people have.
They didn't have the education and communication. Exactly. At least we talked about those two.
Exactly.
We should also remember, perhaps restating, you know, Burke is a Whig. He's the liberal. He's the reformer in the anti-monarch party, in a sense. It's not accurate simply to see him as a defender of the ancient regime or something like that.
Despite all the times he refers to the importance of the ancient regime.
Again, it's the whole reform versus revolution question, and you know, we hit on that. So,
yeah, and if Trump wins and makes himself king, then it will just have been a reform. We voted for it, and it'll so all hail King Trump.
Yeah, that's the way it works. You become president, you just declare yourself king, and then you're king.
All right, folks can continue the conversation with us via on our Facebook group or on our blog, partiallyexaminedlife.com. Please become a Partially Examined Life citizen. Maybe you could start a not school reading group about this topic. Maybe you could start reading groups about purely political stuff if you want, or stuff that has nothing to do with this, about Malebranche.
For those who have attended addiction treatment without success, there is hope. The National Institute on Drug Abuse claims there is no single treatment option that is right for everyone. Gulf Breeze Recovery is a non-12-step holistic treatment facility that is successful in helping people break free from the addictive lifestyle. Visit gulfbreezerecovery.com or call 855-6-HOLISTIC-REHAB.
Hey, once again, for our closing song, I'm going to take the opportunity to pull from the catalog of one of my interviewees for our sister podcast, Nakedly Examined Music. On our most recent episode there, number 27, I talked to Peter Knight, the violinist and one of the singer-songwriters for Steel Eye Span, which is a British folk rock band. It's been around since the early 70s. Both his playing and his songwriting, just beautiful, heartbreaking stuff. And our conversation really covers not only musical techniques, but producing art in the face of mortality, being authentic, which is a particularly interesting topic for that band, given that a lot of their output has been recreations of traditional folk songs, right? How do you do something authentically that was written hundreds of years before you were born? One of the old tunes that Steel Eye Span covered back in the day was called Hard Times of Old England, which was given a rather chipper interpretation at that time. Well, what you're about to hear is Peter's current trio, called Peter Knight's Gig Spanner, from his Layers of Ages album, 2015. This is a different version of Hard Times of Old England that actually expresses how hard the times were. And I thought this was very appropriate for this episode when thinking about tradition. Was it really that great in Britain back in the day? And the same could go for Making America Great Again, of course. I hope you like it, and check out the interview at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.
all along. Oh, pray come and tell me where the trade is all gone. Long time have I travelled, and I cannot find none. Sing all the hard times of old England, in old England, very hard times. Provisions you buy at the shop, it is true. But if you've no money, there's none there for you. Oh, what's a poor man and his family to do? Sing all the hard times of old England, in old England, very hard times. And you must go to the shop, and you'll ask for a job, and they'll answer you there with a shake and a nod. And that's enough to make a man turn out and rob. Sing all the hard times of old England, in old England, very hard times. Poor tradesmen walking the street from morning to night for employment to seek, and scarce have they got any shoes to their feet. Sing all the hard times of old England, in old England, very hard times. And our soldiers and sailors have just come from war. They've been fighting for Queen and country this year. They've come home to be starved. They should have stayed where they were. Sing all the hard times of old England, in old England, very hard times. Thank you.
I hope that these hard times will not last long, and I hope soon to have occasion to alter my song and sing all the good times of old England. In old England, jolly good times. Sing all the good times of old England. In old England, jolly good times. Sing all the good times of old England. In old England, jolly good times.